From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It is through terrorism that the people that have committed this terrible act express their values. And it's right at this moment that we demonstrate ours.
Today on Democracy Now!, we spend the hour looking at the terror attacks in London. At least 50 people are dead and hundreds wounded in the worst attack in that city since World War II. We'll go to London to get reaction from British anti-war MP George Galloway, Guardian columnist George Monbiot, and others. And we also examine our nation's rail security. Is the government doing enough to protect U.S. transit systems? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is in California at a conference. Here are the headlines. The confirmed death toll from yesterday's coordinated bomb attacks in London has risen to at least 50, making it the deadliest attack in London since the Second World War. More than 700 people were injured in the attacks. A massive intelligence investigation is now underway, and evidence is emerging that the attacks may have been carried out using timing devices, raising comparisons to the Madrid bombings. A previously unknown group that calls itself the Secret Organization Group of Al-Qaeda, of jihad organization in Europe, claimed to be behind the attacks. In a statement posted on an Islamist website, the group said the attacks were, quote, in revenge of the massacres that Britain is committing in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll have much more on this in just a few moments. Back here in the U.S., the Department of Homeland Security has raised the nation's security level for subways, buses, and commuter trains to code orange for mass transit. From New York to San Francisco, stepped-up safeguards included bomb-sniffing dogs, increased video surveillance, and more police at train and bus stations. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said Thursday that authorities had no evidence of a specific, credible threat against the United States. During their coverage of the breaking news events yesterday, several Fox News hosts or reporters made comments that are raising some eyebrows. The network's Washington managing editor, Britt Hume, told host Shepard Smith that when he heard about the London bombings, he saw it as an investment opportunity.
I mean, my first thought when I heard, just on a personal basis, when I heard that there had been this attack and I saw the futures this morning, which were really in the tank, I thought, time to buy. Others may have thought that as well.
Fox News Washington managing editor Britt Hume speaking yesterday. Meanwhile, one of the network's anchors, Brian Kilmeade, said the attacks worked to the Western world's advantage, and he blasted the international gathering at the G8 for focusing on global warming and African aid instead of terrorism. Here is some of what he said right after Tony Blair spoke yesterday. This is Kilmeade talking to another Fox host, Paul Varney.
And that was the first time since 9/11 when they should know, and they do know now, that terrorism should be number one.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Just changed.
Yeah, but it's important for all of them to be together. I think that works to our advantage and the Western world's advantage for people to experience something like this together, just 500 miles from where the attacks have happened.
It puts the number one issue right back on the front burner, right at the point where all these world leaders are meeting. It takes global warming off the front burner. It takes African aid off the front burner. It sticks terrorism and the fight and the war on terror right up front all over again.
That was Fox News host Brian Kilmeade and Paul Varney speaking yesterday on Fox News. Thanks to Media Matters for those clips. Egypt says it is temporarily shutting down its diplomatic mission in Iraq and has recalled its staff to Cairo after a militant group claimed to have killed Egypt's top envoy in Baghdad. Cairo also asked the UN Security Council on Thursday to urgently address the issue of protecting diplomats in Iraq. A group identifying itself as Al-Qaeda in Iraq said in a posting on a web forum that it killed the Egyptian ambassador who was kidnapped from a Baghdad street late Saturday, only weeks after he took up his post in the Iraqi capital. The group posted a short video of the diplomat being questioned but did not show his slaying. The top lawyer for deposed Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has quit the Jordan-based legal team, saying Thursday that some of the team's U.S. members were trying to control the defense and tone down his criticism of the U.S. occupation and of the current Iraqi regime. The lawyer has often expressed support for Iraqi resistance. Among the Americans on the team are former U.S. Attorney General Ramz Lark. The lawyer charged that Clark and another American lawyer helping to defend Saddam were, quote, upset with my statements and have often asked me to refrain from criticizing the American occupation of Iraq and the U.S.-backed Iraqi government. Saddam's legal team includes 1,500 volunteers and at least 22 lead lawyers who come from several countries, including the United States, France, Jordan, Iraq, and Libya. No date has been set for Saddam's trial. Former FBI agent Colleen Rowley, who landed on the cover of Time magazine after blowing the whistle on the nation's pre-911 security lapses, announced this week that she is running for Congress against two-term incumbent Republican U.S. Representative John Klein of Minnesota. Rowley was a strong opponent of the invasion of Iraq. She said, quote, "We must reclaim a foreign policy ethic that restores America as first among equals and shakes off this terribly distorted image of America as the Lone Ranger shooting from the hip." A judge in Venezuela has ruled that an opposition figure who was received by President Bush will go on trial with three colleagues accused of conspiring to overthrow the government using U.S. funds. Maria Corina Machado and three other members of her Sumate group, which helped organize a referendum against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez nearly a year ago, are being charged with conspiracy to change Venezuela's Republican system. Chavez has called Machado a traitor after her Sumate group received funding from the National Endowment for Democracy. The judge ruled that the three would remain free until the trial took place. Machado met Bush at the White House on May 31st. The NATO alliance announced that it has started a three-month airlift of African peacekeepers into Sudan's devastated Darfur region. In a statement, NATO said that the operation began with the deployment of Nigerian troops into the region last week. It said the airlift would continue into September. NATO and the European Union agreed last month to help fly some 5,000 troops from African Union nations into Darfur to strengthen the existing monitoring force of 2,700 troops. A lawyer for a Canadian believed to be among the youngest prisoners at the Guantanamo prison camp argued Thursday that the teenagers should not be forced to undergo further interrogation by Canadian authorities. The prisoner is now 18 and was captured in 2002. He is accused of killing an American medic in Afghanistan. A lawyer for the Canadian government said he has provided useful information and Canadian investigators should be allowed to continue questioning him. Attorneys for Lindy England, the Army private who became the public face of prisoner abuse at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, said Thursday that she would plead not guilty when the Army reopens her court-martial later this summer on charges of mistreating Iraqi prisoners. Earlier this year, the 22-year-old had agreed to plead guilty to several charges in return for reduced prison time. But an Army judge threw out her plea in May, saying the confession she had worked out with Army prosecutors was not believable. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who is in Monterey, California, at the Alliance for Community Media Conference. Today, we spend the hour looking at the terror attacks that rocked London yesterday. The death toll from the coordinated bomb attacks has risen to at least 50, making it the deadliest attack in London since the Second World War. The final death toll is not yet known due to the dangers of reaching some of the underground blast sites. 700 people were injured in the attacks. 22 of them are in critical condition. A massive intelligence investigation is underway to find those responsible. British Home Secretary Charles Clark said looking for potential bombers was like searching for, quote, needles in haystacks. He also said the number of dead is expected to rise. A series of four bomb explosions struck London's transport system during the morning rush hour. Three London underground trains were hit within half an hour, and a London bus was hit 30 minutes later. The four explosions came between 8:51 a.m. and 9:47 a.m. The blast occurred one day after London was awarded the 2012 Olympics and coincided with the first full day of the G8 summit in Gleneagles, Scotland. Prime Minister Tony Blair flew back from the summit immediately after the attacks and gave an address from 10 Downing Street. This is an excerpt.
It is through terrorism that the people that have committed this terrible act express their values. And it's right at this moment that we demonstrate ours. I think we all know what they're trying to do. They're trying to use the slaughter of innocent people to cow us, to frighten us out of doing the things that we want to do, of trying to stop us going about our business as normal, as we're entitled to do. And they should not and they must not succeed. When they try to intimidate us, we will not be intimidated. When they seek to change our country or our way of life by these methods, we will not be changed. When they try to divide our people or weaken our resolve, we will not be divided, and our resolve will hold firm. We will show, by our spirit and dignity, and by a quiet but true strength that there is in the British people, that our values will long outlast theirs. The purpose of terrorism is just that. It is to terrorise people, and we will not be terrorised. I'd like once again to express my sympathy and my sorrow for those families who will be grieving so unexpectedly and tragically tonight. This is a very sad day for the British people, but we will hold true to the British way of life.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking at 10 Downing Street yesterday. U.S. President George Bush expressed his condolences and said, quote, we will not yield to terrorists and will find them and bring them to justice. Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said Thursday's coordinated attacks bore all the hallmarks of the Al-Qaeda network. The attack, which was a coordinated strike against transportation systems during rush hour, closely resembled the Madrid bombings last year that took 91 lives. A previously unknown group calling itself the Secret Organization Group of Al-Qaeda, a jihad organization in Europe, claimed to be behind the attacks. In a statement posted on an Islamist website, the group said the attacks were, quote, in revenge of the massacres that Britain is committing in Iraq and Afghanistan. The group also threatened Italy and Denmark unless they removed troops from Iraq. Police said they couldn't confirm the authenticity of the statement. Cabinet ministers said forensic teams were hunting for clues on who carried out the bombings and whether suicide attackers were involved. The New York Times is reporting that timing devices rather than suicide bombers set off the explosions. While British officials contend the security level in London had been high, the domestic intelligence agency M15 had advised businesses in the past 2 months that the threat from international terrorism in Britain was lower than at any time since September 11th. The attacks led to the complete shutdown of the London Underground network, and many roads near the affected stations were closed, severely congesting road traffic. Police urged London commuters to consider whether to come to New York to work on Friday, to avoid burdening the transport system. London is the world's oldest subway system, transporting 3 million people each day. We go now to London to speak with journalist Stephen Gray, who is with the Sunday Times of London. We're also joined by George Galloway, who is the former British MP who was expelled from the party in October of 2003 because of statements he made opposing the 2003 invasion of Iraq. In January 2004, he formed a new political party, Respect the Unity Coalition, and was returned to Parliament as its candidate. We're also joined by George Monbiot. He is an author and columnist for the London Guardian, and he is the author of the book Manifesto for a New World Order. He just arrived back from the G8 summit in Scotland. Welcome to all of you, and I'd like to start with Stephen Gray, journalist with the Sunday Times in London. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Hi.
Could you tell us what is the latest information on what is the aftermath of the bombings?
Well, as you've said, the police have just had a press conference and given us some more facts about the latest situation. The fatality count is now at least 50, but we do expect that number to rise. What the police have said now is that there is a tube train, a subway train, still underground with the carriage where the explosion took place, which up till now they still have not managed to reach, and there are many bodies inside that carriage. We're absolutely certain that there's no one alive there, but there's a scene of an unimaginable carnage down there, very difficult to reach. There are safety issues, whether the tunnel itself may be in danger of collapsing, and therefore the police are proceeding with extreme caution in getting to that place. We've also heard that the size of explosives used was probably around just under 10 pounds, the kind of explosive you could put in a small backpack. The police are guiding us that they don't have any evidence at this stage that these were suicide bombs, that it is conceivable that these were devices that were left on the trains and on the bus by individuals, perhaps with timers, that sort of thing. That's the latest on the investigation, and London itself has gone back to work. There are 10 out of the 11, 12 tube lines are now working again, and most people have reacted to this with quite a degree of calm, which perhaps reflects the fact that obviously London has been targeted before over the years by terrorists, particularly the Irish Republican Army, although not with the same devastation we saw yesterday in terms of lives lost. And as one policeman on the scene pointed out to me yesterday, the difference with the IRA was, generally speaking, they did provide some kind of warning in advance of their attacks, allowing a degree of evacuation of these scenes, but no such warning was provided yesterday before the attacks.
And George Galloway, the respected member of Parliament, your reaction, you were quoted in some American newspapers here as saying that that England had reaped the results of its involvement in the war in Iraq.
Well, London has reaped the involvement of Mr. Blair's involvement in Iraq would be more accurate because, of course, the vast majority of Londoners, and I have no doubt the vast majority of the people affected by that despicable act of mass murder yesterday, were opponents of Mr. Blair and Bush's war on Iraq. This was an atrocity, as you've just been hearing, but it was also the site of some great heroism and public service from the very public service workers, underground workers, firefighters, and ambulance staffs and health service workers and policemen and so on, who are praised when they're heroes like they were on 9/11, but when they ask for a decent living or to stay in the public service rather than be privatized, they're routinely denounced by the same government ministers now, heaping praise upon them. The British are going about their business today, as your last speaker said, with the stoicism for which our country is famous. And we must continue that. But it would be entirely dishonest to pretend that this came out of nowhere. Inexcusable, but not inexplicable. Sadly, all too explicable and explained even before we did it by the anti-war movement. We said this would not make the world a safer place. It would make the world a more dangerous place. And just like all the other things we said about the war on Iraq, sadly, we've been proved right again yesterday, as we have been so many times.
We're talking with George Galloway, anti-war MP from England. We're also speaking with Stephen Gray of the Sunday Times of London. We're going to take a break for stations to identify themselves, and we will be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be right back. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, and we're talking with several guests in London over the situation of the bombings that occurred yesterday. We're talking with George Galloway, an anti-war MP from England, also a journalist with the Sunday Times of London, Stephen Gray, and we're going to be talking soon with George Monbiot, the author and columnist for the London Guardian. I'd like to get back to Mr. Galloway. Your criticism of the Britain's participation in the war. Apparently, there was a rebuttal from Home Secretary Charles Clark, who said that this has nothing to do with Iraq or any other particular foreign policy. It's about a fundamentalist attack on the way we live our lives. And he apparently was reacting to your criticism yesterday.
Well, only a fool would say that, and only a fool would believe that. In fact, the terrorists themselves have said in the website to which your previous caller referred that that's exactly why they carried out the act. So only a fool believes that this came out of nowhere. It came out of a deep swamp of hatred and bitterness that we have soaked in blood these last few years. This is obvious to any sentient being. And the only way that we can truly resolve this matter, and of course, in the interim, in the short term, I'm thoroughly in favor of the most rigorous policing and intelligence response to try and stop these dastardly acts from happening. But the only way we can really be clear of them, the only way we can be safe from them, is if we reduce the number of people out there who are ready to support those who are ready to hurt us. The fish has to swim in water, and Bin Laden is swimming in this water, in this swamp that we have created.
George Monbiot, columnist with the London Guardian, your views on what happened yesterday and the impact on England in the future.
Well, first I'd like to say that at the moment we don't know who planted these bombs. It's a fairly good guess that it was someone affiliated with Al-Qaeda or a similar organization. But we must be cautious about this, because if you remember what happened in Oklahoma or remember what happened in Madrid, in both cases, the wrong people were initially blamed and the wrong intelligence leads were followed. I understand what George Galloway is saying, it's actually too early to say that this is because of such and such a policy, because we don't yet know who the perpetrators were. However, I would broadly endorse what he said about not creating conditions which are likely to stir up more terrorist acts. And there's no doubt that by invading Iraq, we have caused a great deal of resentment and anger within the Muslim world. And if that hasn't come back to haunt us yet, then it may well come back to haunt us in the future. But as I say, we don't yet know, A, who did this, and B, what their motivation is. So it really is too early to start saying this is because of a particular policy that we followed. As far as its impact on Britain is concerned, I'm worried that we're going to see the loss of certain civil liberties as a result of this. We've seen with, for example, the Patriot Act in the United States, that there's been quite a curtailment of some fairly basic human rights, including the right to free assembly and the right to free expression. And, of course, there's been a great deal of intrusive surveillance and policing of the Muslim community and indeed parts of the non-white community in general in the US, some of which appears to have very little to do with anything which could reasonably be regarded as dealing with terrorism. And I'm concerned that that's going to come over here. I'm concerned that the draconian restrictions on protest that we already have in this country could be extended. Already we've seen several people saying that this provides justification for the introduction of a new identity card in Britain. We don't yet have an identity card, but they're talking about an identity card which includes biometric identification and plenty more besides, which could turn into quite an oppressive state tool if we're not careful. And it's also, of course, a further effect is that just as we were all beginning to talk about some of the other issues that affect our lives, such as climate change, such as global poverty, such as what's happening in Africa. These are all issues which we desperately need to be discussing. Those have been knocked off the front page and knocked out of the front of people's minds. And so while this awful event, this dreadful attack, has been a terrible, terrible tragedy for the people caught up in it, it could have further ramifications which could themselves have tragic implications for many people in Britain and around the world.
And Stephen Gray of the Sunday Times, your sense of the impact of these attacks on the G8 summit itself and its ability to even get much work done?
Well, I think a lot of the work is done by officials, and so the work will continue. I suppose that it's more of a political effect in that it's changed the focus away from what's a pretty important work there, and obviously vital for Africa. And if clearly the degree in which people are able to put pressure on those leaders has been diminished, really, because the focus has gone away. Can I just come back on what George Galloway and George Monbeau were saying? I don't, as a reporter, don't want to comment on the sort of rights and wrongs of the Iraq war, but I would just obviously just put in context. I think a lot of people in London will obviously see a lot in what George Galloway is saying. His remarks will have a lot of resonance with people who've expressed views on the Iraq war. But obviously there will be others who will take the view that we should in fact strengthen our resolve in operating in Iraq for the sake of not giving in to terrorists. But I would say one important thing where I think what George Galloway says resonates with what I've seen. I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East recently and in Iraq, in fact, last year. I think one important thing to understand about the nature of Islamic terrorism is that it's not just about a threat to the way of life of the West. If you talk to people who are actually close to these movements, I mean, they hate, above all, the policies of the West. And, I won't comment on those policies, but they extend much what they are, not just the invasion of Iraq. They also extend to our policies to the Middle East peace process, our involvement in Afghanistan. Many of the people who are drawn to these movements are not people who are looking for some sort of Taliban lifestyle. They're people who are actually motivated because they support some kind of insurgency about the way the West is dealing with the Middle East, and they feel the Middle East is utterly humiliated. The Middle East people are utterly humiliated by the West and the Western policies, and this is the response they seek. It's an appalling response, but I think to understand it, you've got to understand it goes a lot further than simply a kind of revulsion against the Western way of life.
I'd like to get back to this, the whole issue of the possible targeting of Muslims in England. George Galloway, you represent a district that has a large Muslim population. The Islamic Human Rights Commission yesterday warned London Muslims to stay home, fearing a backlash. And The Guardian has learned that within hours of the attacks, 30,000 abusive and threatening emails were sent to the Muslim Council of Britain's website. Your reaction to the possible targeting of Muslims in England?
Well, I'm just looking at my own computer screen now. I'll just give you the title of one of them, Pig Islamists. And that sort of person is out there. But I must say to you that I think the British people are bigger than that. And I disagree with the advice, if that was what it was, that Muslims should stay indoors. In fact, they should unite with the rest of us in absolute rejection of terrorism and of war. We must be tough on terrorism and tough on the causes of terrorism. It's really basic common sense. It's not left wing. It's not rocket science. It's just basic common sense that if you don't drain the swamp that I've talked about, if you don't intervene to stop the ongoing calvary of the Palestinian people, who for 50 years have been dispossessed, sent to the four corners of the world as refugees, regularly massacred, occupied. If you don't do something about the hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers occupying Iraq, if you don't stop propping up the puppet presidents and the corrupt kings who rule the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other, then you lay bare your double standards, your hypocrisy when you talk about liberty. What our leaders want is liberty for us, but only up to a point, and they're ready to take that away if it suits them, but no liberty for anybody else. And the people in the Muslim world can see it very clearly. They know that nobody gave a toss about the thousands who were killed in Fallujah. Nobody in the British Parliament raised any qualm about the American armed forces reducing Fallujah to ash and killing thousands of people. Yet they go into the kind of emoting that we saw yesterday about the deaths in London. I'm different from that, and most British people are different from that when you reach them. The blood of everyone is worth the same. God didn't differentiate between a dead person in London killed by sheets of flying glass and red-hot, razor-sharp steel, and someone who died the same death in Baghdad. These deaths are the same. And war of the kind that we've seen, unjustified, illegal, based on lies, in Iraq, is terrorism of a different kind. Just because the president who ordered it is wearing a smart suit rather than the garb of an Islamist in the Tora Bora doesn't make their orders more legitimate than orders if they were given from bin Laden.
Well, George Galloway, I'd like to bring back George Bombio into discussion. You just came back from covering the G8 summit. And, of course, the press attention before yesterday was focused not just on the summit, but on the massive protests of the British anti-war movement that was outside the summit as well, and the anti-globalization forces that had massed to protest the summit. Your sense, George Bombio, of the impact on that movement of these attacks?
Well, we've completely fallen off the news agenda, and I completely understand that. I'm not complaining about it. It's just what happens. But unfortunately for what we were trying to do, we were really making some gains. We were beginning to mobilize a lot of attention, not just to the issues that we were initially complaining about, that is the tremendous power of the G8 nations over the rest of the world, power exercised through the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the UN Security Council. But we were also very successfully articulating our dissent from the line taken by Bob Geldof and Bono and the other leaders of the G8 and of the Make Poverty History campaign, which has been quite extraordinary and exceptional in many ways. They have managed to mobilize billions of people around the world and push the issues of Africa and poverty to the very top of the political agenda. But those of us, the many thousands of us who met in Edinburgh and then at Glen Eagles in order to protest against the G8 summit, drew a very sharp distinction between what we were doing and what we felt that Bono and Geldof were doing, which was protesting to ask the G8 summit for favors, to beg, as we saw it, for a few more crumbs from the rich man's table. And in doing so, we felt that they were fetishizing the power of the G8 leaders. They were saying, you have the world in your hands and you must now use this power to save that world from itself. Of course, what they weren't talking about was saving the world from themselves, from the G8 leaders, and the disastrous policies they are pursuing in Africa and elsewhere. And we felt and had expressed very strongly that the Live 8 and Make Poverty History campaigns, in many ways, were taking us back to an Edwardian era of tea and sympathy, that they were replacing our political campaigns with philanthropic campaigns. And they were handling the G8 leaders as if they were the potential saviors of the world, while completely ignoring and sidelining the harm that they were doing. And it's one of the effects of these dreadful bombings is that just as we were really making progress with that, it's now completely off the agenda. And that's fair enough, but it's just an unfortunate side effect.
And Stephen Gray of the Sunday Times, your sense of the impact long term of these attacks on British society and on this rather large and developing both anti-war movement and movement questioning the growing gap, the economic gap in the world.
That's a big question. I think the British people are quite calm about dealing with these matters. I think there will be some reaction. There inevitably there'll be some hate generated. There will be attacks on the Muslim community. But I think that these are just as a terrorist attacks perpetrated by very small minorities. We have a very multicultural society here in London, and I think that most people very well understand the very small numbers of people involved. They realize that the terrorists would probably disguise themselves very effectively as normal citizens here, so then they'll see that there's no need to target anyone who, you know, looks overtly Muslim. I think that we'll look at it in quite a broad sense. Quite a calm sense. And broadly speaking, I think that as time progresses, they will obviously think about the causes of all this. But there will be a reaction. I mean, the investigation itself is going to be very difficult. Obviously, we've seen no large-scale roundup of suspects this morning. The police are trying to investigate this with great sensitivity. But obviously, in order to get to these people, they are going to have to make all kinds of inquiries. If it does turn out that an extreme Muslim group is involved, then they will have to engage with the Muslim community, have to get information, and no doubt they'll be arresting people, and that will cause some reaction and disturbance. It's a very difficult thing to investigate, and clearly there will be some backlash, and I think everyone will have to stay quite resolute, which I think they will, but it will not be an easy time, and clearly they may also be further demands for much tougher police action, security powers, etc. Although ultimately I'm not convinced that it's through tougher security and essentially a kind of semi-military response to terrorism that you deal with the underlying causes, which and stop the recruitment of these people, which is ultimately what we need to do, because as we've seen, Al-Qaeda as an organization is becoming more of an idea that is inspiring people around the world. And it's no good simply arresting people you regard as a leader of this organization. You have to address why it is that people are popping up all over, subscribing to the ideology and perhaps having no links whatsoever to the leadership in Afghanistan, or if not arrested somewhere. And therefore, it's the ideas that are going to become paramount. And it's actually showing that the ideology of Al Qaeda is bankrupt, and that the West has an alternative which can also appeal to the Muslims who feel dispossessed.
And if I may interrupt just to get a final comment, a quick final comment from George Galloway in terms of how you see the impact of this on Tony Blair. And you were expelled from the Labour Party for your opposition to your strident opposition to the war in Iraq. Your sense of how this will impact on Tony Blair?
Well, it could go either way. It could give him a new lease of political life. He may decide that his declaration of impending retirement sometime in this parliament needs to be set aside. Or if there's a Spanish-like phenomenon now sweeps the country, it could mean the political end of him very soon. I hope it's the latter, because I think we need a change of policy, and we're not going to get a change of policy without a change of leader, because the leader, both here and in your country, is so utterly identified with the policy that we have been following. Now, you have midterm elections coming up rather sooner than we have a general election. My reading of the US situation is that Bush will pay a very high political price at those elections. And we'll see on the streets and in the public opinion polls and on the airwaves and in the letters columns of newspapers and so on here in Britain, which of the two alternative ways that this could go will actually happen.
Well, I'd like to thank George Galloway, Member of Parliament and a noted anti-war leader in Britain, George Monbiot, the columnist for the London Guardian, and Stephen Gray, a journalist with the Sunday Times. Thanks to all of you for being with us. We're going to take a 60-second break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll be back. This is Democracy Now! Thank you. Welcome to Democracy Now! The bombings in London marked the second time in 2 years a train system in a major European city had been targeted. On March 11, 2004, in the Spanish capital of Madrid, in a series of bombings left 191 people dead and more than 1,800 injured. On Thursday, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff announced that the government has placed public transportation systems in the country on higher alert.
The intent of al-Qaeda and its affiliated organizations to attack in Europe and in the United States has been well documented and continues to be reflected in intelligence reporting. We have already taken additional measures to secure transit systems since 9/11 and since the railway bombing in Madrid. At the direction of the President, we are working with the Department of Transportation, our other federal partners, state and local officials, and transportation authorities to take all necessary precautions and to increase the security of our transportation systems and the citizens who ride them. We have asked state and local leaders and transportation officials to increase their protective measures, including additional law enforcement, police, bomb-detecting canine teams, increased video surveillance, spot testing in certain areas, added perimeter barriers, extra intrusion detection equipment, and increased numbers of inspection of trash receptacles and other storage areas.
That was Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff speaking on Thursday. In New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg vowed that the city's trains were safe to ride.
I know that New Yorkers are concerned that this type of attack could be replicated here in our city. But let me assure you, we are doing everything in our power to prevent that from happening.
Thursday's blasts in London raised new questions about security on the nation's public transit systems. During the average work day in this country, 14 million people ride public buses, trains, and subways. In a single month, the nation's public transportation system carries more passengers than U.S. airlines carry in a year. However, a group of critics inside and outside of government are accusing the Bush administration of not focusing enough on protecting the country's public transit systems. Since the September 11th attacks, the federal government has provided public transit systems $250 million under the Transit Security Grant Program. The American Public Transportation Association has complained that this has been an inadequate amount. The trade group points out that over the same period, the federal government has given the aviation industry over $15 billion, more than 60 times as much money. We're joined now by Congressmember Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's a Democrat who represents the District of Columbia. She serves on the House Homeland Security Committee. Last year, she introduced the Safe Trains Act. We're also joined by William Millar, the president of the American Public Transportation Association, which represents more than 1,500 public transit organizations around the world, including the London Underground. And we're joined by Stephen Flynn. He's a senior fellow for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of America the Vulnerable, How Our Government is Failing to Protect Us from Terrorism. He served in the White House military office in the Bush administration and as a director for global issues on the National Security Council staff during the Clinton administration. Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton from the District of Columbia. I'd like to start with you. Your sense of the disparities, if they do exist, between government support for security for the aviation industry versus mass transit.
Well, they're quite outrageous. After the fact, and I'm on both the Homeland Security Committee and on the Aviation Subcommittee, after the fact, of course, we've done what we had to do, and upwards of $15 billion dollars has gone into aviation security of one kind or the other, something approaching $400 million into public transportation security. And it ought to strike everybody as very strange that Mr. Chertoff, the new Homeland Security Administrator, was from Washington giving a recipe of what public agencies should do, trash cans and the rest. That tells you everything. It tells you that no one would ever do that today to airlines, because airlines know what to do because there's been some congressional action and oversight, but there has been so little systematic action, so little money from Washington, that here you have the Homeland Security Secretary literally going down a checklist of what public transportation operators should do. How pathetic 4 years after 9/11.
William Millar, president of the American Public Transportation Association. Why? Why the disparity and what's behind it?
Well, I think the original reason, as the congresswoman has said, everybody understood we needed to secure the airline system. And I don't think anybody begrudges the money that's been spent on airline security. But our transportation system is made up of far more than that. We're talking about public transportation today, but it's also highways and bridges and the ports and the waterways and everything else. And it would seem to us that after nearly 4 years since 9/11, it's time to begin to address that balance. 32 million times a day, Americans use public transportation. Less than 2 million times a day, Americans use the nation's airline system. Seems to us that that in a time of national security, as the president says we are in, national security issues such as this, that only the federal government has the resources to provide the kind of funding so that transit systems across the country can do the types of realistic things that are necessary to both make them safer and, frankly, make the millions of Americans who use it feel safer. Both are important.
But if you say you don't begrudge the airlines the help that they have gotten, clearly they've been better capable of lobbying for that support than have the mass transit systems around the country, no?
Well, I don't see it quite that way. I think everyone in the world watched 9/11 and the repeats of that and the repeats of that on TV and heard it on the radio, and everybody realized the airline system had to be made secure. Public transit is one of those public utilities that when it's operating well, nobody notices, nobody stands on the corner and says gives it great praise. Then you have these occasional incidents, such as in Madrid, such as in London, where it gets momentary focus, and then it's back to business as usual. The fact of the matter is many in the Congress do not use public transit. Everyone in the Congress does use the airline system, and so I think it's more obvious to people in the Congress. But Congresswoman Holmes Norton and many others in the Congress have been calling for additional aid, and we're very hopeful that her bill and other bills like it that are being talked about again will be reintroduced, and we hope that this time around, now that we have two major examples in the world to look at, that more of the Congress and the administration will look favorably upon the need for additional aid this time around.
We're also joined by Stephen Flynn, the retired U.S. Coast Guard commander and an expert on homeland security and border control. Your perspective on this disparity between aviation security and mass transit security?
Well, it's really unacceptable, but it really reflects two things. First, that the administration has made quite clear that they believe the federal government's responsibility is primarily the war overseas and the policing of our border. And right in the president's homeland security strategy, which he put out a little over a year after 9/11, he says quite explicitly that when it comes to safeguarding critical infrastructures within our society, that the burden needs to be shared by local and state authorities, and, quote, there's sufficient market incentive for the private sector to protect itself. The fact that our transit systems are run at the local level, or state or regional, but primarily local level, and that the federal government has carved out this division of labor that says that when it comes to federal resources, it really is being put in the war and terror overseas, and states and locals need to fend for themselves, is clearly a challenge when so many states and localities are having a difficult time just keeping their transit system up and running, never mind adding rather expensive improvements. The other side of the second issue is that there is this almost sense that it's hopeless, that there is nothing that can be done. They're very open systems. There's too many people. One can think about how we can police, do security at airports because you're funneling people onto planes, a controlled environment. But here, I think we missed the point. One is that it's impossible to protect a system 100% of the time, like a transit system. There's a lot that we can do in terms of raising the awareness, both in terms of training of the transit operators as well as the general public, which means that our politicians need to do a little less of everything that can be done is being done, so just go about life as normal, and a little more talking about the limits of what they can do and what everybody else needs to contribute. The other side is it's very much about response, about being able, given that these accidents will happen, having the exercises so that you can evacuate people, you can get the system up and running quickly. Here, I think the Brits deserve a lot of praise, both in their ability to respond to this well, and also in terms of managing a lot of the public information that's coming out. And that's the kind of investments that we need to make. Not huge sums of money in many cases, but it does require resources. And the federal government has to exercise much more leadership than it's been willing to exercise to date.
But transit systems, obviously, around the country are all cutting costs because so many of them are publicly funded and depend on taxpayer revenue, so that you have a situation, for instance, in New York City, where they're cutting, they're beginning to have trains with no conductors for the first time, just with the trainmen, it would seem that in that situation, the level of at least being able to respond to an immediate emergency would grow even less than currently exists.
Well, I think that's certainly the case, is that the trends are not going in the right direction overall. Well, certainly some efficiencies are always going to be what we work our way through. But the fact is, we don't recognize these things as critical to our way of life and our quality of life. Major cities like Washington, D.C. and New York just simply cannot function without mass transit working. So it's not only that lives are, you know, there actually are ways, if you went up to sport events or something else, where you could kill more people. But what we're seeing with Al-Qaeda and its imitator organizations are geared to do is to cause economic and societal disruption by going after things we really, really depend upon. And our mass transit system, again, largely unobserved because they're almost always working well for those who use it, but the fact is they are the lifeblood of our major cities, and our major cities are a lifeblood of our economy. So American citizens really got to start to make a investment in safeguarding these kinds of facilities. And frankly, they deserve investment even if it wasn't a terrorist threat, because of their economic role.
Because I don't think when we talk, we ought to understand what we're talking about in investment and the difference between mass public transportation and aviation. And we're really not, there are two ways to look at this. There need to be developed smart security for mass transportation. We haven't begun that process. Meanwhile, my bill would begin with a very small amount of money, you know, when you compare it to the $15 billion that aviation has got, $3.5 billion. And what would that be used for? It would be grants where public transportation systems, that means people who operate buses, ferries, not just subways, rail, light rail, could apply for grants to do the obvious, to get dogs to have ventilation equipment, so that if you're underground, people don't simply suffocate when a bomb goes off, perhaps even in one car. These are not your aviation type costly approaches. What I was able to get into the Homeland Security authorization is equally primitive, a national plan for public outreach and awareness. Here we have the television telling people, hey, look around you, make sure that if you see anything suspicious, you report it. We don't tell public transportation systems, there's not systematic direction from Washington or security expertise from Washington given across the board to transportation systems of all kinds and all varieties. So
Representative Norton, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off at that point because we're out of time for this segment, but I'd like to thank you all, Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton, Congresswoman from the District of Columbia, William Millar, President of the American Public Transportation Association, and Stephen Flynn, a retired U.S. Coast Guard commander and expert on Homeland Security, for being with us, and we'll be continuing to follow this issue other editions of Democracy Now! We turn now to Damus Smith, who's a living legend. He founded Black Voices for Peace and the National Black Environmental Justice Network. He hosts the program Spirit in Action on Pacifica Station WPFW, and he has been a leading activist for decades. Damu is now fighting for his life. Earlier this year, he was diagnosed with advanced stages of colon cancer. Supporters are organizing fundraising events around the country to help with his medical and personal expenses. The goal is to raise at least $150,000. Well, welcome to Democracy Now!, Damu.
Well, good morning, Juan, and thank you for having me this morning.
Well, you are well known to in many circles in Washington and around the country as a longtime peace activist. And can you tell us a little bit about your experience and what happened, particularly in terms of when you found out that you had colon cancer?
Well, you know, I found out in late March that I had advanced stage colorectal cancer and liver cancer. And, of course, this hit me like a ton of bricks, like it would anyone. But, you know, Juan, I felt that I needed to turn this experience into something that could benefit not only my own health and life, but others. And so for the last few months, the Spirit of Hope campaign formed to provide support to me and my family has expanded to talk about how we can raise some issues around healthcare justice and other issues. So tomorrow night here in Washington, there will be a national tribute to me hosted by Danny Glover and Bernice Johnson Reagan at Howard University's Crampton Auditorium at 7 p.m., preceded by a health and wellness fair at 5:30 p.m., also at Crampton Auditorium. And I'm just so happy that people coming from around the country with Amiri Baraka and Hakeem Adebuti and Al Sharpton and Sonia Sanchez and many others in the Washington area. And so we want to bring together people to raise these issues, and we want to talk about how we can organize a national campaign for health justice, even as we're focusing on my situation. And people can call 202-265-4919 or visit www.damusmith.org to find out more information about the national tribute tomorrow here in Washington.
Well, that's Damu Smith, and we urge all of you who can to attend that program. That's tomorrow night. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Anna Laguerra, Elizabeth Fresh, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, and Nell Geiser. I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!